Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. It's hard to imagine a life that could be more extraordinary and fascinating than that of Lucy Parsons, who was born from biracial parents and born into slavery in 1851. She had become one of the best known and feared anarchists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Lucy Parsons, who advocated for the violent overthrow of the capitalist class, was arrested countless times during her life by police who tried to stop her from public speeches. The FBI even raided her home in the early 1940s after she passed away and stole away her personal writings. Now, her husband and fellow anarchist and labor leader, Albert Parsons, was one of four people who were executed for the turmoil during a labor strike at Haymarket Square in 1886 that would forevermore be commemorated in May Day demonstrations as well as celebrations. Lucy Parsons was a founding member of the Wobblies. She inspired the likes of Eugene Victor Debs and Mother Jones, and she even sparred with fellow anarchists like Emma Goldman. Well, today we're going to be in conversation about Lucy Parsons. My guest is Jacqueline Jones. Jacqueline Jones is the author of the book Goddess of Anarchy, The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. Jacqueline Jones, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
And a fascinating story. How did you come upon telling this story? Why did you tell this story about Lucy Parsons?
I knew about Lucy Parsons as the wife and the widow of Albert Parsons. And she seemed to be an enigmatic figure, a rather mysterious figure, because no one seemed to know too much about her origins, where she was born, how she got to Texas. Those early years of her life were really obscured, and I was interested in finding out more about her and learning about her background as well as her role as a really very prominent anarchist in the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
Yeah, there's always been, I guess it's been unclear about her past and who and where she comes from and some controversy, all that as well. But you trace it right to Virginia. I mean, there was even some questions about that before, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. She presented herself to her public after 1886 or so as the daughter of Mexican and Native American parents. But this was a fiction she developed, and I think she feared that if her adoring audiences knew that she was a woman of color, a woman born into slavery, that she would lose credibility. So she created this fiction. She created this myth about herself. And I was only able to find her in the census and elsewhere by doing a really rigorous check of the newspapers that covered her in the late 19th century. I came up with what I called the Rosetta Stone of Lucy Parsons' early life. It was an article in the St. Louis Globe Democrat from October 1886, and it gave the name of her mother, the name of her owner, the name of her mother's husband, and other details that I could later confirm by looking at the census. So it was a rather circuitous route back to Virginia. Yes, she was born in 1851 in Virginia as a slave. She and her mother and a younger brother were forcibly removed from Virginia to Texas during the Civil War by their owner, a Confederate surgeon. And after the war, she and her mother and then two younger brothers moved to Waco, Texas, where she met Albert Parsons. So recreating that early life of hers was really exciting for me. I think it helps to explain who she was and certainly what she became in her later years as well.
Is what you did the first time a historian actually traced all the way back to her birth and her parents?
Yes, yeah. Yes. There had been, again, this conventional understanding of her as a Hispanic woman, as a woman of Native American parentage, but that turned out to be false. And it was a story she concocted just as she was about to begin a national speaking tour in 1886. And again, I think she wanted to present herself to audiences as an exotic person. She was light-skinned. It wasn't easy to tell by looking at her what her heritage was. And she aimed, I think, to take advantage of that ambiguity.
And her parents were, she was born into slavery, so was her mother black?
Yes, and her mother, by the description of her, was very dark-skinned, and Lucy, of course, was light-skinned, so it's pretty clear, and this was the understanding of people who knew her in Waco, that a white man was her father. We don't know whether it was her owner, or it could have been her owner's son, or perhaps another white man on the plantation.
Interesting. You mentioned she came to Texas, would end up in Waco, Texas, and this is an important spot because this is where she meets Albert Parsons, who she would marry. But before we get into that story, tell me a little more. Her coming to Texas is interesting, and if I recall correctly, she had a walk from Virginia to Texas, which was perhaps common for many slaves at the time. Why were slaves from the South during the Civil War coming to Texas?
Yes, she was part of a large migration of enslaved people out of the South into Texas during the course of the war. Certainly, there were owners of slaves who feared that with every advance of the Union Army, their human property was at risk, and they wanted to take their plantations and the enslaved laborers on those plantations out of what they considered harm's way. In the lower Mississippi Valley, there were Confederate officials who were impressing enslaved workers. That means they were taking them from their owners and putting them to work in the service of the Confederacy, digging trenches, building fortifications. And there was also, on the part of at least some owners, the conviction that slavery would never die in Texas, that the state was big enough to protect itself from Union advances, and that even if the South lost the war, Texas would somehow be able to maintain the slave system. So we don't know exactly how many enslaved people came to Texas during the war, but it was many thousands. And Lucy Parsons, her mother and her younger brother, and at least one other person from this plantation were, as I said, forcibly removed to Texas at this time.
And emancipated, the word of emancipation came late to Texas. I mean, isn't that what Juneteenth is all about?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is. That is the day when Union officials declared that slavery was over in the state of Texas. I should make it clear, though, that slavery existed in one form or another for many years after on these very isolated plantations. Owners were intent on keeping workers hard at work. There was a great deal of violence in Texas right after the war, and an effort to keep formerly enslaved people hard at work. So the end of slavery came slowly, came gradually, it came in an uneven way to Texas. And there was a great deal of prejudice and discrimination against these former slaves. That's why her mother, Lucy's mother, Charlotte, took her family from McLennan County, where they had been living on a plantation owned by this Confederate surgeon, and moved them to Waco. Waco was a small town, but they thought they could find some refuge, some safety there from the violence on the countryside.
And just the story in Waco is fascinating. Even because obviously, much of the story about Lucy Parsons as well as Albert Parsons will happen when they go to Chicago. But I was enthralled by just the account of what happened in Waco, Texas, and including, let's bring Albert Parsons into this conversation now as well, including the fact here's Albert Parsons, along with Lucy Parsons, maybe two of the most well-known radical leftists in American history. Yet Albert Parsons, so hear about Lucy Parsons who was born into slavery at a walk to Texas from Virginia. Albert Parsons was actually a Confederate soldier.
Yes, he was.
I was surprised by that, yeah.
He was the younger brother of William H. Parsons, a Confederate general, and he served with his brother's unit and with other units as well during the course of the war. He was a scout. He enlisted when he was about 16 and served for really 4 years in the Confederacy, in the Army, and then returned back to Waco. And what's interesting about Albert is that he decides he's going to become a Republican. He's going to renounce his service to the Confederate Army. He's going to agitate on behalf of the rights of the former slaves. He's going to try and get black men to register to vote. And in the process, he puts his life in danger. He travels around the countryside speaking to large groups of freed people and urging them to fight for their rights. So this is a very unusual couple. Albert Parsons, the former Confederate, the veteran of the Confederate Army, Lucy, formerly enslaved. They really were quite an unusual couple in Waco, and people certainly took note of them in that town at that time.
How did they meet? What led for them to become a couple?
It's unclear the exact moment they met, although there are several points of connection between the two of them. Albert was very active in the Republican Party. I think he was planning to run for office if he could at some point. Lucy Parsons attended a school for former slaves that was taught by a Republican, David Davis. And I think the agitation among white Republicans there in Waco involved a very small number of white men, and it was not hard for the two of them, I think, to find themselves together at certain points. I will also say that Lucy Parsons was, by all accounts, from black and white men and women, very beautiful. She was a real head-turner, if we could say that, and did not lack for admirers during that period, and Albert Parsons was certainly one of them.
And again, this is during the early years of Reconstruction, before Reconstruction, I guess, goes bad. This is a period of time in which we're seeing a large number of African Americans actually being elected.
Yes, it was a hopeful time. It was a time of black political participation. Black people were determined to exercise their full rights as citizens at this point. And Albert Parsons seemed to be very much part of that effort as a white ally of black office holders, black Republicans. So it was an exciting time. And obviously, the fact that Albert and Lucy met and fell in love and decided to marry indicates that they did hope for a future that would allow black and white people to live together on an equal basis. I found that they did manage to marry in September of 1872, which seems very unusual given the prejudice against interracial marriages at the time. But for about a year or so, the Republicans were in charge of Texas politics. They held all the major statewide offices. And Albert was very shrewd because he found a local judge, I think probably the mayor of Waco, actually, who was a Republican, who would marry the two. And so they did formalize their union in 1872. Within a year or so, the Democrats would reclaim the state and these interracial marriages would be criminalized again. But for a brief window there, the Parsons were able to take advantage of this opportunity.
Again, both Albert and Lucy Parsons would become anarchists, were known not to support voting later on. But early on, Albert Parsons was running for office all the time, for some elected position all the time.
Yes, they moved to Chicago in 1873 and right away became immersed in the German immigrant community of Chicago, which was a radical community. Albert became very prominent as a socialist, as a speaker for the socialists there, exhorting workers to exercise their rights, to defend themselves against predatory capitalists. He got a very prominent reputation as an eloquent orator and writer at this time, and he was determined to run for office, for local office in Chicago, and become part of the establishment. He soon, though, became disillusioned by the political system. He thought it was rigged. He thought he had been cheated out of office holding. He became very cynical about voting. And it's about that time in the early 1880s when he and Lucy turned their backs on socialism and embrace anarchism. And one of the characteristics of anarchists at this time was that they would have nothing to do with voting. They believed that both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, were corrupt, that the politicians were not ever sincere about supporting the laboring classes. So they do turn their back on the political system at that point and embrace anarchism.
Now, both Albert and Lucy Parsons are serious intellectuals, writers, prolific writers, orators. Albert Parsons, I imagine, got a lot of that, and he was probably also just naturally inclined towards speaking, but I imagine got a lot of his education just from, he was connected in the publishing world most of his life, even as an apprentice, as a young man. Where did Lucy Parsons' education come from?
That's a good question, because as far as I can tell, she had only about 2 or 3 years at most of an elementary school education there in Waco during the 1860s. But from what I can tell, when she and Albert moved to Chicago, she began to read widely and deeply. She read local newspapers, popular magazines. As part of a very vibrant socialist community in Chicago, she read political theory, history, and economics. But by and large, I think she was self-taught. She begins to write in the late 1870s. She writes letters to a magazine called The Socialist. And by the time Albert begins to edit his own paper called The Alarm in 1884, she's a well-known writer in radical circles in Chicago, and she spends the rest of her life really writing for a variety of radical newspapers, and she edits two of her own.
Mm. Yeah, she's, I guess we'd call her an autodidact then.
Yes, I think so.
And she could hold her own, I mean, with anyone.
She could. She loved debating. She loved taking people down. She had no compunction about criticizing fellow socialists or anarchists if she thought they were wrong about something. She was quite the formidable intellect. And in addition, she loved to speak before large audiences. I think she was the happiest when first she was in front of a large adoring crowd, haranguing them about the need to resist their capitalist masters, and also when she was dodging the police who would come after her and try and silence her. So she was really fearless. She was a fearless intellect, and she was a fearless orator.
Do you get a sense of where that came from for her?
I'm not sure, but certainly I think she was very well aware, obviously, of her own background and the fact that she felt she could not be honest with her audiences about her origins. And as a result, she seemed to have a certain formidable temperament. She disputed with critics. She ridiculed her critics. She expressed contempt for politicians and police. She didn't hold back, and there was a backbone. She had a backbone that I think must have been the product, again, of this very difficult childhood, and her determination that she would prove to people what a brilliant and determined person she was.
We're in conversation about the life and times of Lucy Parsons. Our guest is Jacqueline Jones. She's the author of the book, Goddess of Anarchy, The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. So Jacqueline Jones, Lucy Parsons and Albert Parsons, why did they leave Waco?
It was clear after they married and after the Democratic Party regained control of the state that they would have no future.
This is the backlash.
Texas.
This is the backlash of Reconstruction.
Yes, and also as an interracial couple, they were going to face continued discrimination. Albert, I think, did have political aspirations at that point, but once the Democrats came back into power, he realized he was not going to be able to win political office and become the political leader he hoped to. So I think the two of them had made connections with German immigrants in Texas. Germans were very much a part of the constituency of the Republican Party in Texas at that point. And I think Albert probably met someone who said to him, you know, I have friends or I have cousins or relatives in Chicago who would be happy to welcome you into that community if you want to move there. I think that that probably was the connection between the Parsons and Texas on the one hand and Chicago on
Chicago.
The other.
And that's interesting to me. I wanted to ask you about German immigrants. I mean, Lucy and Albert Parsons end up, this is pretty much the community that they seem to associate most with when they get to Chicago. This is also a community known for radical activism. What's going on with German immigrants?
Some of them certainly were fleeing persecution in their home states in Germany at that point. There was a crackdown on socialists. Many of them were very much educated in radical activism at home and brought that activism into Chicago. And in fact, we find that the socialists and later the anarchists are taking their cues about labor organizing from the radical tradition of Western Europe. In other words, they're importing this strategy of agitating among the laboring classes from immigrants. And as it turned out, that strategy was not well suited to organizing native-born white workers for a variety of reasons. But the Parsons and socialists and anarchists alike seem to persist in these ill-fated strategies of organizing.
And you say ill-fated strategies. Why?
Well, for instance, as Western European anarchists, in the mode of Western European anarchists, the Parsons denigrated the United States government, the state. They expressed contempt for institutions such as Congress. They also ridiculed the church. They were anti-clerical. They said that anyone who voted was a fool, and they argued that the future for all workers looked bleak, that only poverty and starvation awaited American workers unless they could launch a revolution. Well, many native-born workers and many immigrant workers too rejected that very bleak outlook. They were more hopeful, if not for themselves, than for their sons, who they hoped would do better in life. They prized certain American institutions, the public schools, the right to vote, and they felt aggrieved when they were made to feel foolish for having these kinds of hopes about their own future and the future of their children. And also, many American workers were religious. They had loyalties to a particular religious denomination, and also loyalties to a particular political party, either the Republicans or the Democrats. So, in other words, these European strategies really were not suited for organizing American workers. In fact, they were more calculated to appeal to immigrant workers.
Yeah, and the Parsons never had huge following, though they had following, albeit small. But one person who perhaps took them more serious than anyone were the police.
Yes, they presented themselves as a very, very powerful group, a larger group than they were. As I note in the book, they began to talk about dynamite in the mid-1880s, arguing that dynamite leveled the playing field between the workers on the one hand and the police on the other. They were determined, I think, to scare the authorities, whether politicians or police, into thinking that as anarchists they were much more powerful than they really were. And this obviously turned out to be a very problematic thing to do, because then when someone threw a bomb in Haymarket Square on May 4th, 1886, the authorities rounded up what they considered the usual suspects, those men who had been arguing that explosives, dynamite, were the key to the revolution. And Albert got caught up in that. His rhetoric, his writings had been very provocative. And he, along with the other defendants, were considered guilty by association. I should make it clear here that no one knew of the identity of the bomb thrower. We still to this day don't know who threw that bomb that killed 7 policemen, killed 4 other people, and wounded many, many more. But the men who were eventually tried and convicted, and 4 of them were executed for the Haymarket bombing, were all writers, editors, anarchists, whom the police feared because of their rhetoric as much as anything else.
And then what, 4 of them were executed, including Albert Parsons?
Yes, 4 were executed, 5 were condemned to death, 1 committed suicide in his jail cell before the execution. But Albert and, 3 others were executed on November 11th, 1887 in Chicago.
And the 4 men who are being hanged at this time, including Albert Parsons, they all get an opportunity to say something before the trapdoor opens, except for Albert Parsons. It opens while, is just beginning to talk?
He's just beginning to talk, and it's clear he's going to call on fellow workers to resist the tyranny of the capitalist class, and his words are strangled. He is hanged before he can utter words at that point. Oh, can I say just one thing?
Yes, you can.
I did make a mistake, and when Albert was on the scaffold, he did manage to get a few words out.
That's right.
He cried, "Let the voice of the people be heard." Oh, that's on page 203. So those words actually became legendary later on. "Let the voice of the people be heard." Oh, and I wouldn't want people to think that he had died without getting anything out at all. So I wanted to make that correction.
What do we know about Lucy Parsons' reaction to all this?
Certainly the papers covered her very carefully. They sent reporters out to her home. They were there when she saw Albert's corpse in the coffin. She was distraught. By this time, though, she has gained for herself a name as an agitator in her own right. After Albert and the others were convicted, she began a national speaking tour to raise money for the defense. And it's in the fall of 1886 and the spring of 1887 that she begins to reach very large and enduring audiences, men and women who want to hear her. They're curious about her. She's quite an eloquent speaker. She's a very commanding presence on the stage. She's tall. She's beautiful. She can hold a group in thrall for 2-3 hours, and papers all over the country are covering her, are writing about her, and the speeches she gives, she's completely unapologetic. She says at one point, you might be looking for the grieving widow or widow-to-be, the mother of two children who was distraught, but in fact, she says, I am an anarchist, I'm proud of it. My husband is going to be killed by the authorities for his beliefs. And she is quite composed and quite admired, even by her detractors, for her eloquence and her ability to really keep the attention of a large crowd for quite a while.
Yeah, 2-3 hours. I could barely do 50 minutes on the radio. Tell me about... What does it mean, and I guess around the 1870s, 1880s, and onward, what it means to be an anarchist, and how would you characterize her political philosophy?
She doesn't fit well into our Republican versus Democrat or conservative versus liberal binaries that we're familiar with today. She was a critic of government in all its forms. But she was not what we today would call a libertarian. She believed that trade unions were the building blocks of the good society. In other words, she believed in voluntary associations of like-minded people who would work on a cooperative basis to provide for each other. She was against wages. She believed that everybody was equal. She certainly disparaged the notion of identity politics. She claimed over and over that her own background was irrelevant to her message. She was interesting in that she presented herself as a rather prim Victorian mother, wife, and later widow, when in fact she was quite a sexually liberated person. Most interestingly, I found that she was not at all involved in the struggle for Black civil rights during this period. Many radicals, socialists, anarchists of this period were very much focused on urban white wage earners and considered that group the vanguard of the revolution. Chicago had a Black population during this period, men and women who worked in service positions, who were ill-paid, discriminated against, but the Parsons never paid them much mind, never paid attention to Black people. So her life, I think, is full of ironies and contradictions, which all make her a very interesting person.
Yeah, the fact that she didn't talk about race was interesting to me.
Yes, she again believed that white wage earners should be the focus of her agitation. Again, here I think that was kind of a Western European radical model. She expressed very little interest in sharecroppers and other landless farmers in the South because she believed that rural workers really were not that integral to the coming of the revolution. So on one level, she was very prescient. She argued that machines were taking the jobs away from wage earners and soon would leave not only the laboring classes, but the middle classes as well without jobs. And her understanding of technology in the workplace, I think, was accurate. On the other hand, she did not have a full sense of the prejudices held by white workers, their prejudices against women, against children, against Chinese, against African Americans in the labor force. So she was consistent in her views over the generations, but that consistency was really not warranted. I mean, Chicago was growing. It was developing a consumer culture. It was growing its economy and adding all sorts of new kinds of jobs in the service sector, the entertainment field. And Parsons and other anarchists were really not attuned to those critical changes in the way they might affect workers generally.
Again, we are in conversation with Jacqueline Jones. She is the author of the book, Goddess of Anarchy, The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. I do find that interesting. It was seen, especially by white workers during this period, that blacks migrating from the South and then also Chinese, maybe Chinese immigrants, were a threat to their own way of life, their own ability to find a job that pays well, or decently anyways.
Yes, I mean, they tended to demonize the most vulnerable workers in the population. Chinese workers on the West Coast, to African Americans in the cities. These groups were considered by whites to be strike breakers. And they were not interested in bringing them into unions for the most part. There were exceptions, but by and large, white workers feared these vulnerable groups and, as I said, demonized them in the process.
What was her involvement in the creation of the Wobblies?
She was there in Chicago in the summer of 1905 when the Industrial Workers of the World were founded. She sat next to Big Bill Haywood, and she was on the stage with Mother Jones and other luminaries. I think that these men invited her originally as a symbol of radical activity from the past. She was considered an icon at that point, the widow of the Haymarket martyr, Albert Parsons. And yet, during the course of the proceedings, she expressed some impatience, I think, with these white men. She felt they were patronizing her. She said at one point she wanted to speak, and not just as kind of window dressing, but as an agitator who had something to say, especially to younger people in attendance. So she was allowed to speak after she insisted. But again, and she was invited, I think, largely for her symbolic value at that point.
What did her next big issue, or you'll correct me on this, but it seems like she took up issues around free speech and the First Amendment. How did that play out? And was this because she was constantly being harassed by police when she was trying to speak?
Yes, by the late 1880s and early 1890s, she was, of course, quite notorious among Chicago police circles. The police chief was determined to silence her because she attracted such huge crowds and because her rhetoric was so violent. She used to say things like she would like to power the guillotine that would chop off the heads of capitalist tyrants. And the crowd loved that kind of thing. The police, not so much. So by the early 1890s, they are interrupting her speeches. In some cases, they're trying to make her display the American flag, which she does not want to do. And it's clear that she's going to become a very determined defender of the First Amendment. She insists on her right to speak. She will not let the police intimidate her. And it takes a lot of courage. You can tell these, not only the undercover detectives who are in attendance at all her speeches. She begins to recognize them. They're ubiquitous. But also, of course, the uniform police who often break into her speeches, come up to the stage, hustle her off. You think after a while, most speakers would become discouraged, but that only seemed to make her more determined. And I think the beginnings of the free speech movement, if we can find any beginnings at all, do go back to Lucy Parsons' speeches there in Chicago in the late 1880s and early 1890s.
Oh, that's interesting. So would you see that? And when we think of free speech movement here, and I'm talking to you from Berkeley, California, we think about the 60s and in 1964 at UC Berkeley. Of course, there's issues, you know, really connected to the Cold War that goes decades before that. But this is a precursor to all that.
Yes, and I think most people think about not only Berkeley, but the free speech campaigns of the industrial workers of the world right around the time of World War One. These were the campaigns in the Northwest and the West Coast. Wobblies would declaim on soapboxes and be arrested by the police. They would fill the jails. They would make headlines in the process. It was really quite an active period in terms of the fight for the freedom of speech. Lucy Parsons was associated with that in the sense that she would travel to the West Coast and the Northwest during this period and sell copies of her biography of Albert. In fact, she made a living there for many years selling his books, his essays, pictures of him, as well as the biography of Albert Parsons, which she helped to put together after he was executed. So she had a long career. She was still speaking well into the 1930s and up until she died in 1942. She was really a very common presence there in radical labor circles in Chicago during that period.
She died in a house fire.
Yes, she did. And there are real ironies, I think, there. Again, she was 91 years old when she died. She left the stove on, I think, and went into the basement. When she came up, the house was in flames and she was caught in that. But she, over the generations, had been derided by her critics in terms that seemed to evoke the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So they would say she was giving incendiary and inflammatory speeches. They would say she was a red-hot firebrand who was trying to spark a revolution among the laboring classes. I mean, there's all this fiery metaphor about her, which I found very interesting, because when she and Albert arrived in 1873, the city was just recovering from the Great Chicago Fire 2 years before.
And just such a momentous time, the 1870s in Chicago. You have the great rail strike of 1877. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked about Haymarket, but it was a lot more than just what was happening in Haymarket. You had transforming the society. I think you touched upon this earlier, just where, you know, because of technology, people's jobs were disappearing. I mean, we think this is all happening today, but no, we've seen the cycle before.
Yes, indeed. And the big corporations were trying to cut back on wages to save money. So the Great Railroad Strike of the summer of 1877 was that was sparked by employers who tried to make workers continue to work long hours, but at reduced pay. And it was during that time that Albert Parsons came to the fore in Chicago and stepped up as an orator. He urged workers to organize, to resist, and he certainly garnered the attention of the authorities in the process. But that really begins his career on the stage, I think, in Chicago as a well-known radical. And later, Lucy says that it was the violence against workers in the summer of 1877 that set her on the road to her anarchism. The police that summer interrupted peaceful assemblies of workers, peaceful meetings. In one case, entered a meeting of furniture workers and actually shot one of them to death, although they were just meeting and discussing among themselves. So I think that was pivotal, that moment, because both Parsons and their comrades believed that the police were naturally aggressive, naturally violent, and it was up to the laboring classes to protect themselves against these violent security forces, police forces. And that's when Albert begins to urge the workers to arm themselves, to protect themselves. And later, of course, that exhortation for self-defense spills over into a more aggressive, assertive promotion of radicalism and violence in particular.
Jacqueline Jones, in my introduction some 40 minutes ago when we began this conversation, I indicated that Lucy Parsons would spar with fellow anarchist Emma Goldman. What was the issue between Lucy Parsons and Emma Goldman?
Well, both certainly were very strong-willed women. They were editors. They were writers. They clashed over one particular issue. Emma Goldman became a very well-known proponent of free love, the idea that monogamy was ill-advised, that people should naturally embrace multiple partners. Lucy Parsons, again, as I mentioned, presented herself as a prim Victorian. She thought that the family was a very key component to the good society, the relations among family members, husbands and wives, parents and children. And she was outspoken, Lucy, in radical circles, pushing back against this notion, which became more and more popular among anarchists in the late 1890s and on into the 20th century, the idea that an anarchist would, by definition, embrace free love, would denounce monogamy. And Goldman, interestingly enough, really disliked Parsons for this reason and told crowds, audiences, that Parsons was basically a hypocrite, that in fact she did live her life as a sexual free spirit, and we know that's pretty much the case. She took lovers after Albert's death. She had a child by someone in Waco. We're not sure the identity of the father before she married Albert. So she really was a sexual being in her own right, and yet she could not bring herself to admit that or to talk about that publicly.
How would you characterize Lucy Parsons as a mother?
It's very difficult to make a generalization here. She had two children. Albert Jr. was born in 1878. Then Lulu was born 2 years later. Lulu died when she was eight of complications from, I think, scarlet fever. But certainly Parsons left the children with neighbors, with friends on many, many occasions when she was out of the city speaking. I must, though, mention that in 1899, when she was very much a critic of U.S. imperialist adventures abroad, that her son, Albert Jr., came to her one day and said that he was planning to join the U.S. Army and go off to the Philippines to fight. And this, she just could not tolerate the notion that her son would not only join the Army, but also humiliate her in the process. She right away
dragged him. That's like the first overseas imperialist war, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. In Cuba and
Spanish-American
the Philippines.
War, yeah.
And she took him before a judge of the insane asylum court, had him declared legally insane, had him committed to an insane asylum north of Chicago, where he died 20 years later. And there is no evidence that she ever visited him while he was there. So that was a shocking story. I think I had to think about that. Why did she do that? Why was she so cruel?
All because he wanted to join the military?
Well, we don't know whether that was the only reason. I think he had, by that time, embraced religion. It was clear he was not going to follow in his father's footsteps. She had proclaimed very loudly and very often that Albert Jr. would become his father's successor and lead the radical movement, and he had no interest in doing that.
Jacqueline Jones has been our guest. Again, Jacqueline Jones is the Ellen C. Temple Chair in Women's History. She also holds the Mastin Gentry White Professorship in Southern History at the University of Texas at Austin. She has joined us for a conversation about Lucy Parsons. Her latest book is called Goddess of Anarchy, The Life and Times of Lucy Parsons, American Radical. Jacqueline Jones, that was informative and quite interesting, and I thank you greatly.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.